Thank you for joining us, ladies and gentlemen. We are live Saturdays, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern from Studio M in Los Angeles. I am Stephen Spear, and this is TalkRadio1.com for Saturday, the 30th day of April, 2022, which means it's my niece Jennifer's birthday. Happy birthday, Jennifer. As you know, I was in the hospital for 15 days a year ago, January. So January of 2021 for 15 days with COVID. And we talked about that in a show that I did on January 30, 2021. I was just 6 days out of the hospital. And if you haven't heard that show, I'd really recommend it. I think you will get more about COVID and a hospital experience if you ever think you might have a hospital experience or would like to be prepared for one. This show will give you a better idea of what that's like than you could get from 2 years of COVID, fractured media coverage about COVID. Then this year, on January the 22nd, I talked with my guest today. My guest today is Buzz Hollander. He's a medical doctor, Buzz Hollander, MD. And he was on the show, on this program here with me on January 22 this year. You can listen to that. We spoke extensively about COVID and about the CDC and the government and the vaccines and the vax or not vax. And we talked about lots of things in a way that was so practical and so useful. We've gotten a lot of comments about it. And so we're going to talk about COVID for just a couple of minutes right now, because I don't know if there's that much to talk about these days for most people. And then we're going to move on to talk about our medical system, how you can get the best medical care, and even how you might accidentally get the worst medical care. And so it is my pleasure to say, Dr. Buzz Hollander, welcome back to TalkRadio1.com.
Thanks for having me back on, Steve.
Let's just get a quick update. Where are we now? What should we as individuals think and do now about COVID?
Well, we're getting some different messages, obviously. I was surprised to hear Dr. Fauci tell us that we are out of the pandemic phase of COVID-19. I'm not quite as sanguine as he is in terms of, I don't think it would take much to find ourselves back in situations where hospitals could fill rapidly and have that sort of unpredictable element that really defines epidemic stage disease. But I hope he's right. It certainly seems plausible at this point that we might sail through till summer, and then we'll see what happens when the air conditioning comes back on in the South. Maybe we'll do okay. Maybe there's so much immunity out there between vaccines and Omicron after Delta that we can get through this with only flu-like hospitalization strains, and that would be fabulous. I'm not ready to bet the farm on it yet, Steve.
If I'm vaccinated and I'm boosted and I'm second boosted, I am all three of those things, how careful do I need to be when I'm in public, if I go to Disneyland, if I go on an airplane, an airport, a movie theater? How careful do I need to be?
You've also got a big case of COVID in your rearview mirror too, which is probably still doing you some good as well. So I think there's been some, The Economist ran a really nice piece maybe about a month ago in which they tried to break down the risk of COVID for a truly immune person like yourself compared to the risk of flu. And it ends up being pretty similar. And you could even make the case that because the flu vaccines are less effective than our COVID vaccines, that you might be at less risk. So if you're the kind of person who still traveled and still went to restaurants and shows during flu season in years past, if you found that risk to be acceptable, then you might well find the risk of COVID to be acceptable now.
Do you think I have a look forward to a fifth shot or a sixth, or do you think at the end of the fourth shot, which I've had, that I'm finished?
I don't know, because we obviously don't have long-term data on the fourth shot. I think all the short-term data we have really points to the conclusion that it does not give the sort of benefit that a second shot in the series and probably a third shot does in terms of longer-term protection against severe disease. It is probably just a topping off of short-term immunity for a month or three. So I, what I tell my patients now, I'm happy to change my tune if we get different news from the research that evolves. But I tell them that pick your slot for getting your fourth shot, because you're just going to have added protection for probably just a couple months. So wait till prevalence is high in your area, or you've got a wedding coming up or a funeral, or you're going to travel somewhere with high prevalence and be on airplanes, because after you get this fourth shot, then you're probably going to wane back down to the same protection you had prior to that within a couple months. So if you get it now and then there's a big summertime wave, then you're not going to have any extra protection. So it looks to me most likely that unless we get some shift in the technology, whether it's a new protein that they're going to put in the vaccines, which obviously they're looking at hard and getting close to approval, or a different type of shot, you know, an intranasal or something, then until or unless that happens, you're really looking at short-term protection with each booster. So it'll probably evolve to be more like a flu season kind of thing. The problem is the flu season is fairly predictable and COVID season, not quite so much.
Is there anything else that comes to mind that you want to say about COVID, COVID protection, COVID vaccines, anything else before we move on to other topics?
The thing that strikes me, and it just has continued to disappoint me throughout this pandemic, is the amount of shoddy science coming from all sides on this. And when I say sides, I mean, you know, the conventional CDC people and then the people on the other end of the spectrum who love to poke holes at everything the CDC says. But the low quality science and the hot takes that don't really hold up to common sense, they continue to flow in. And I keep trying to move away from COVID. I'm trying to start writing regularly on regular topics of medical interest. And I keep getting pulled back into COVID because somebody famous says something that just infuriates me. So I'm hoping that changes, but I'm not optimistic that it will.
Dr. Buzz Hollander lives on the big island of Hawaii, and he has 17 years of experience in both clinical and emergency room settings. He's a specialist in family law, and he graduated from Princeton University. He attended the UNC Chapel Hill School of Medicine and completed his residence at California's Santa Rosa Family Medicine Residency Program. Dr. Hollander has written extensively on all things COVID and on many other medical subjects. I asked him to join me again today because, as you can already hear, he just makes sense. It's just that simple. My father was a physician. He practiced medicine from the time he graduated medical school in 1939 from the University of Illinois, Chicago School of Medicine, until he retired in 1984. Now, I'm very aware that that's 38 years ago and lots of things have changed since then. But during his 45 years of medical practice, he delivered over 3,000 babies. He practiced pediatrics and geriatrics. He set bones. He did surgeries. He was a general practitioner until in 1970 he became a charter diplomat of the Family Practice Board when it was originated in the state of California. And so he was what you'd call a good old-fashioned doctor, and he spent tremendous amounts of time sitting with his patients. He would know all about their family and their family history, their medical history, but their family history. How's your marriage? How is your relationship with your parents, your children, your spouse, your work, your money? What aggravates you? How are you in every single way? He knew all of those things because he would sit and talk at length with each patient. He was very successful in his practice. He had a tremendous number of patients that came to him over the years. And this was back in the days when medical insurance really didn't exist as such. There was a thing called major medical. So if you were in the hospital for more than a week, the insurance company would pay. But otherwise, you just wrote a check to your doctor for the office visit. And you, if you needed a test, you paid for the test. And whatever it was affordable. But when the insurance companies came in and made a business out of that, it made everything unaffordable and opaque. You couldn't tell what you were paying for, and it's resulted in some of the changes. More on that as we go. But what my dad said in 1970, when there were a large number of medical malpractice cases against doctors and multi-million dollar verdicts, is he said, medicine's going to change. You're no longer going to have doctors in private practice. You're no longer going to have house calls. You're no longer going to have solo practitioners like my dad. You'd never survive financially. You needed a group. The insurance companies would be running the practice of medicine and telling doctors what you could and couldn't do, and running the hospitals and telling the hospitals what you could and couldn't do. And there would be major pushes as a result of all of this interference to have the government take over and run it, and to have the government run it. And my dad didn't have, as I don't have, any confidence that the government can really do a lot of things well. We need our government to do the things that only government can do, and we should have the debate over what government should be doing. It's not a question of big or small government, but it's a question of what can the government do. So with that long preamble, you made a shift in 2016, and you did something very, very different in a medical practice. What did you do?
I want to say, first of all, Steve, that I want to hear more about your father's practice, because I find it so interesting how the more things change, the more they stay the same sometimes.
Let's not come back to it. Let's do that, and we'll go on to something else. You interview me. What would you like to know?
So what was the practice setting for your father? In other words, was he suburban? Was he working out in the country? What was the setting like for him?
His office was on Hawthorne Boulevard in the city of Hawthorne. When he left Chicago and came to Los Angeles, it was 1949. He had been in the Army for 6 years during World War II. And then he moved to Los Angeles and opened his private practice in 1949 in the city of Hawthorne, on Hawthorne Boulevard. The city of Hawthorne is about 12 minutes south of Los Angeles International Airport, so yeah, very much urban, very much in the city.
Interesting. And this is a question I doubt you can answer, but I'd love it if you could, because I've tried to search this information in the past when I was speaking more often about what I did, which is transition what's called a direct primary care practice. But I cannot find any reference out there about, back in his era, which is the insurance era, how many patients would you guess? Did he ever say how many people he cared for on a regular basis? In other words, how many unique patient visits he would have in, say, the course of a year. Did you ever get a sense of that?
70 patients in a day was the most he saw. And then there were days when he would only see 10 patients in the entire day, because he had scheduled the time specifically to be able to sit back in his chair and really listen and talk. So he had a staff at the top of his practice in the 60s and 70s. He had three full-time nurses and a receptionist and a secretary, and he had four examining rooms, an X-ray room, a lab room, an EKG room. He taught himself to read electrocardiograms in the mid-1960s and bought an electrocardiograph and would read them. This, you know, today when you hook up an electrocardiograph, for any of you ladies and gentlemen who have had it, the machine reads the whole thing and tells you if you have a right ventricular conduction delay, or if you're whatever your issue is, the computer tells it to you. My dad would read those little graph lines and would say, look, here is an ST change. This is a problem. And he'd be reading them in the evening after dinner at the card table in the family room. He'd be looking through these electrocardiographs and reading them like he was reading a novel.
Well, that segues into my next question, which is, if he had the capacity to see 70 patients in a day, that means he had a lot of patients in his patient panel. I mean, he must have had at least a few thousand, probably.
Yes,
more.
That's correct. So, he encouraged all of them to come in for annual physicals. He said most don't. He tried to talk everybody into it, never he had, you know, there was a hit rate about 40% of his patients would have an annual physical, but 60% said, no, I'm healthy, I don't know. Or, okay, sure, doc, I'll do that. And he wouldn't hear from him for 5 years. And then they'd come in sick, and that's when he would see them. So, yes, the patient panel was probably several thousand, but some of those people he didn't see for a long, long time.
Right.
Others were chronically ill, and he saw them a lot. So it went in waves. And he was the only guy. It wasn't like he had six doctors working for him. It was him and the nurses, the receptionist, and the secretary.
Hence my next question, which is, with a patient panel of that size and he being the only person available to take call, to handle the bad days, what is your memory, other than him reading his EKGs at the dinner table or after dinner, in terms of, did he have more work than any human being, especially a human being with kids, should be asked to do? Or do you feel like it was a manageable workload, and or the work was enormous, but he loved it, so he didn't care?
It was fascinating. As I grew up, I learned things I didn't expect. When I was probably 10 or 12 years old before I figured out that not everybody's dad, when the phone rang in the middle of the night, would get up and leave the house to deliver a baby. I just thought, because I could hear in my bedroom the phone, and because back then you couldn't turn off phones, the bells weren't, you'd hear it everywhere in the house, and then I'd hear my dad walking down the hall a couple of minutes later and going to hear the car start, and he'd drive out and go deliver another baby. So that was normal. And I never felt, and I think my sister would say the same thing, I never felt that my dad was unavailable ever. He worked 5 days, he worked 7 days a week, five full days, Monday through Friday in the office from probably 9 in the morning until probably 6:30 in the evening, but he was home for dinner. And Saturdays, he worked only a partial day until probably 2 in the afternoon. Thursdays, he worked a partial day starting at noon. So he'd take Thursday mornings off. But that was to go get a haircut and do banking and to do something for my mom and do something else. And then Sundays, he would go to the hospitals for rounds to see hospitalized patients. And I would go with him on many occasions. Sometimes I'd wait in the car because at one hospital or another, he was only going to be in there for a few minutes. And other times he brought me into the hospital, and with the patient's permission on occasions, I would go in to meet the patient in the patient's bed with my dad, and then would step outside while he talked privately with the patient. But it was something, a precursor to now people bring, you know, dogs to hospitals to visit people, and apparently the studies show it helps them tremendously. Well, I was kind of a dog. Patients would light up, and he picked the patients for whom he thought it would be therapeutic. He thought it would be good for me, and it was, and he thought it would be good for the patients that he picked, and he was very careful about who he picked. There was never, I would walk in and these older patients, oh, he's so darling, look what a cute boy. They were thrilled and uplifted by the experience. And what I discovered, and I certainly knew this during my 15-day stay in the hospital in January of 2021 for COVID, I am utterly comfortable in hospitals and with people, oh, I hate going to the doctor, I hate hospitals. I love hospitals. I think they're great. I'm so impressed with their operation and how they do things and what they do. And so that's the impact it had on me. No, I never felt that my dad never thought he was working too hard, but he had come here at the age of 19 from Hungary, not speaking a word of English, and had been put through medical school by his younger brother. Then my dad put Uncle Bill through engineering school. They were impoverished in Chicago, having come here with nothing. My father's father having died in his first year of medical school in 1935. And so he had grown up with an attitude of work is not bad. Work is just what you do. And it never bled over into the house, except, of course, we talked about medical things, which was always fascinating.
But no, I felt I had my father, and I know my sister felt the same way. Every minute we wanted him.
And do you feel with that amount of work that he was putting in, I'm glad to hear that he was happy with it and that you didn't resent him for it as a child, and you got to have your role as a therapy child instead of a therapy dog, so good for you for that, Steve. I grew up in, I was born in 1969, so I came of age in the 70s and 80s, and back then, doctors were the rich people in the neighborhood. That obviously has changed a lot. Now it's Google software engineers are the people with the big cars in the neighborhood. But was he happy with his financial setting? In other words, did he feel like he was making plenty of money for the work that he was doing? Because after all, he got to set the price more or less.
He was very happy. He was very proud of the fact that he had built his practice and then took money and he was careful with money. There was never a shortage of money. When we were going to have a steak, we had a steak for dinner. We ate in nice restaurants. We went on rare short vacations, 3 days, 4 days was a long vacation with the family. But they were frequent. There were probably 4-6 times a year, and he was a doctor. Most doctors are not very good in business. I didn't know that until I started practicing law and represented a bunch of doctors, most of whom were not. But he was very good. He invested in the stock market, in real estate, and there was plenty of money. He had been told when he was entering medical school in 1935, he had been told by two different people. One of them was a medical school professor. Well, you'd better come up with something you can do for a living because you're going to be practicing medicine as a hobby. You'll never make any money. And this was wrong. He made excellent money and did very, very well. And we were always comfortable.
And then the last question for now, I'm sure I'm going to want to circle back some more, but it sounds like he probably didn't retire until he was in his 70s, but it was still a quote-unquote good time to be practicing medicine. Was he able to sell his practice? Did his practice carry on after he retired?
No, and we talked a lot about that at the time. And so my dad was born in 1909. He retired in 1984, so that would have made him 75 years old. 75 years old. He practiced until he was 75. He didn't look his age. He looked younger, and he never told anybody his age because he said if they know they've got a doctor in their 70s, they're not going to want to see him. The reason he finally retired was not particularly because he wanted to, but because he said, this requires that I be absolutely sharp. I need to be on my feet, physically on my feet, almost all day, except when consulting. And he said, I can't miss anything, and I need to stop now while I'm still at the top of my game. So he stopped. And then we talked about selling the practice, and he said, it's out of the question. He said, I'm one of the few solo practitioners now in 1984 that are left. The rest who are nearly my age, if they're not my age. And he said that the practice of medicine has changed such that I can't really, in good conscience, say there is a doctor who I would tell my patients, yeah, all of you should go to this doctor. And so what he did is he slowly wound down the practice. He had a variety of doctors to whom he referred people as he was shutting the practice down, and then he turned off the lights. He gave generous severance to the people who were working for him at the time. He owned the building in which he'd been practicing medicine. He built that building in 1956, and so when he moved out in 84, he rented it out to a dentist, who later bought the building, and he just turned off the lights. That was the end of it. He said, I don't have enough confidence in any single doctor to be able to say, yep, that's the person to go to for everything. He said, I selected the patients who really needed to be able to talk to a doctor. I sent them to this one, the ones who really had this particular problem with their endocrine system or an orthopedic problem or their chronic problems were here, I would send them there. And he's, but no, he didn't sell it.
Interesting to hear that, because these days there are still some solo practitioners out there in the world in the traditional medical model. But what happens when they close their practice down is, I think, not out of a desire to care better for their patients, but simply for a lack of suitors. I don't think anybody can sell their practice anymore. Nobody wants it. It's like a hot potato. It's something to get rid of, to find a way to farm your patients out to other doctors, if you can find other doctors to take them on. And it's medical practices of that nature, solo practices, they don't build value. They're, I think, viewed as a liability, quite honestly, which plays into why we ended up making the changes that we did.
Which brings us to the changes you made. What was your vision, and what transition did you make?
Well, I think it'll help people understand better if they know the background, which I can do really quickly, which is that when I finished my family medicine residency, I pretty swiftly moved out to Hawaii because I just met the woman that I was going to end up marrying, my wife, Michelle. And we're fortunate in that she was living out in the middle of nowhere on this large island in the Pacific. And there happened to be a community health center literally right down the road, about 6 miles down the road in this little town called Honoka. So I was thrilled, and they needed a doctor, unsurprisingly. So I joined them and worked there, both staffing their ER and briefly running it, as well as working, I think, 3 days a week in their general medical clinic. And I did that for 7 years, and I was really pretty happy doing that. It was a great landing spot for a mainland haole, as we're called here in Hawaii, to start practicing, because I got right in the middle of real Hawaiian community. I mean, multi-generational Hawaiians of all ethnicities and all backgrounds, and a smattering of celebrities as well who had moved here. So it was a great place to get a sense of what it's like to really live in Hawaii. And I probably would have stayed there, but we started having kids, and I wanted to be less beholden to the clinic and have more flexibility. So what drove me clearly is a little different than what was acceptable for your father and in his era in terms of the workload and the time away from home and family. And so ultimately, it just wasn't going to work out for me working the hours I wanted there. So I went from this sort of on-tracks job where I would show up in the morning, I'd have my schedule made for me, I'd have to see the people they wanted me to see. But I was done at the end of the day. I didn't have to worry about who's paying taxes to the state for the income we're generating, et cetera, et cetera. And my wife and I started a practice together because she's a naturopathic physician. And we bought an office in another town, and I continued accepting all sorts of insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, private insurance, everything. And I naively did the calculations and figured out that I could continue making my modest doctor's salary, seeing maybe 15 or 16 patients a day. That was the math that I'd done. And of course, like most things, whether it's building a house or buying a car, everything ends up costing more than you think it will. And we did that. I was able to cart most of my patients with me because I'd been with them for 7 years, many of them, and we had loyalty and a good relationship. So they just would see me in my office. I would take their insurance, and I felt very good about that as a community member and a human being, feeling like I was not adding any expense to provide what I felt like was better care than I was able to do in my old setting, where people told me, you know, you got 15 minutes for this visit. It never felt like enough to me. So we had half hour follow-up visits. And the problem was that 16 patients a day was just not, it was too many patients. It required too large of a patient panel, which is a concept we can flesh out a little bit more later, to be able to really spend the time with people that I wanted to. It's one thing the time you have just sitting across the desk from a patient, but it's another when they've got a question after hours, or they need a form filled out, or they have to go see their cardiologist and the cardiologist wants them to take a new medicine and not sure it's a good idea given their other medical problems. There's a lot that needs to be done around a patient that's not done in the little time that you're getting paid for by Medicare, Medicaid, or Blue Cross Blue Shield. So after, that was 2012. So after 4 years of that, realizing that I was not enjoying my professional life, I felt like I was letting my patients down in terms of keeping up with what their needs really were. And we were constantly under financial stress. It's Hawaii is an expensive place to live. And even though we had a modest lifestyle, it was not enjoyable financially in terms of, you know, every now and then having to put a payroll on a credit card and that sort of thing. Wasn't a good feeling in terms of this really how I'm going to spend the rest of my professional life. So that's when we decided to make the shift to a direct primary care practice. And that has made an enormous difference in terms of the quality of my life and the quality of the care I can provide. But of course, it's not without some complications as well.
What are those complications?
The biggest factor in becoming a direct primary care, some people would call it concierge. It's a bit of splitting hairs in terms of what, if there's really a definition for those two concepts. But the idea being that patients are going to pay a doctor a monthly or annual fee to see them, sort of like you lawyers are smart enough to put clients on retainers sometimes. The idea is that I'm paid a monthly fee. We started at $125 a month for an adult, and we're available for them. And there's no further financial transaction that takes place. So on the one hand, it's this beautiful, clean system that's completely transparent. And there's no, how much is my insurance company going to charge me for this copay? Are they going to refuse this or that charge? It's just, they know what they're going to pay me. And if they have to come in and see me or my wife 10 times in a month because they've got a horrible skin infection, or whether they want to play keep away like some of your patients, your father's patients did, and not come in except for every few years, they're going to pay me the same amount. And that part of it is nice and clean and simple. The problem, of course, is that not everybody had $125 a month to spend on top of their often $1,000 a month they're spending on their medical insurance and all of the other expenses in their life. So what's typical when a physician makes a shift from the sort of practice I had, accepting insurance, to a membership-based model is that you lose about 90 or 95% of your patients. And we were anticipating that. And the hard part is a lot of that 90% represented patients that I've been caring for and sometimes 10 plus years. And it was sad. They were sad to be losing their doctor that they built trust over time. I was sad to be losing patients, a lot of whom really represented the salt of the earth types of patients that I've been having since I worked in a community health center. And there's not really a great way around that. I mean, we can talk about some of the interesting things that have been done to try to keep patients with limited financial means in a practice like that. But that was the only hard part. And it was a big hard part is the patients who were very understanding. They would almost always say things like, "Buzz, I understand why you had to do this. The system is terrible and I don't blame you at all. We just can't afford it." But still it was the necessary evil of doing that, because what has to happen to provide that sort of time luxuriant care is you have to care for fewer patients. The math that I did was, a typical, like say a Kaiser doctor has about 2,300 patients on their panel. And if you divide that into the minutes there are per year in a doctor who wants to work a 9-to-5 lifestyle and take a few weeks of vacation, it comes out to about 45 minutes per patient per year. All of their needs, every prescription refill, every hospital visit, every time in your office, about 45 minutes. So you tell me, is that enough time to really care for an average person? It just seemed ridiculous.
It's about the right time for one consultation, in my view. Might be
that's
about
how I 15, feel.
15 minutes short. How big is your patient panel?
So we were open-minded when we started, and we figured we have to just let it evolve to find out how much is too much. And what we found out is when we start creeping towards about 350 patients, it starts getting too busy and I start feeling like I get behind again. Now, as you just said, our patient visits are 45 minutes. They keep going up. I just increased my new patient visit to 2 hours, which I know a lot of doctors would find just hilarious that they could even spend 2 hours with a patient. And I just started doing that last week. And my first patient, I went 2 hours and 15 minutes with.
Right.
So I feel like there's almost an endless amount of things you can discuss with a person if you're really trying to care for their whole health in their whole life. And it just takes time.
I think that's exactly right. It strikes me that what you're doing and you're calling direct primary care sounds a lot like concierge medicine. What's the difference?
I don't think there really is one, Steve. When people try to define it, they will say things like, the charges are higher for a concierge practice. There's a bit of an implication that you're going to be more accessible, spend more time with the patient, do more things like house calls, and make sure your patients have your cell number so they can text you day and night. There's plenty of people doing lower priced direct primary care models that still offer all those things. One of the differences, again, this tends to be nominal more than anything else, is a lot of concierge practices. And so the big player in this field is called VIP medicine. And MDVIP is technically their name. And they are a large organization with a lot of lawyers. They would love you, I'm sure, Steve. And they essentially recruit successful physicians. And then they vet them to make sure that they are going to be successful because they invest a good bit of money in a physician getting started in their practice model. And then they charge a little bit more than we do, or pretty similar, but they take a third of it off the top. But what you get is the stability of having this referral network of MDVIP. And they will still charge your insurance company when you go in to see your MDVIP doctor. So that's something we don't do. We stay completely clear of insurance reimbursement, except when we have to work with them to get things like labs and MRIs covered. But that is a fundamental difference. And it's one that is, in my mind, probably fraudulent, because the intent of certainly Medicare is that a doctor has to sign on to Medicare and agree to not charge the patient anything extra for covered services. So what MDVIP and their cadre of lawyers managed to successfully defend is that they are not providing simply covered services. Their extra work and their confidential and HIPAA-compliant interfaces with patients, all these things amount to not typically covered Medicare services. Therefore, they're allowed to still go back and bill them. To me, it's double dipping. You know, it's a small amount of money compared to the amount they get from their membership fees anyway. And so that model honestly baffles me a little bit, but it's what they chose to do. So we're not a concierge practice by that definition. We're direct primary care, and that patients pay us directly, and we're not seeking reimbursement from insurance companies.
When I look at irisintegrativehealth.com, which is your website, irisintegrativehealth.com, I see that your current charge for one adult is $145 a month, for a couple, $270 a month, so a $20 discount, and for a child only, it's $75 a month. Why would you charge less for a child than an adult?
In general, they're a little less work. That's not always the case.
Because they tend to be healthier, they tend not to have as many sicknesses.
Exactly. They're just less complicated, especially as you get into more geriatric patients, you know, multiple medications to figure out. We rarely have that with kids. And then the other thing is, to a certain degree, it's a loss leader, but it's nice to be bringing fresh patients into the practice. My wife and I both love caring for kids, and it just shakes up the day in a way that I'm guessing it was probably one of the things that your dad loved about his practice, that he would go from literally delivering a baby in the morning to probably attending a patient who was dying in the hospital, possibly that same day. And these are the most meaningful events in life. And
yes,
being a part of it is part of the appeal of being a family or general physician, that most specialties don't get to do.
We got a story about life every night at dinner, and three on Sunday. My dad had so many great stories to tell from his medical practice. It never ended. It was one story after another. And I always thought he was exaggerating or making things up. And he said, well, of course I am. To some extent, these need to be interesting to you because otherwise you won't listen to him. I thought that was a great comment. I'm wondering, why don't you charge more for senior citizens? You charge less for children because they are less complicated, less have it. You rarely see heart disease, strokes, or cancer in children. It happens, but it's rare. But in senior citizens, you see all sorts of things. Why don't you charge more for seniors?
Some practices do exactly for that very sensible logic. But some don't, and we fell in that category mostly because it feels like a bit of a slap to people to say, okay, you're going to turn 65 or 68 or whatever and decide to retire and reduce your income stream. And now we're going to penalize you for being older and make you pay more of your limited income stream or pension or whatever to us. So that was really the logic, even though, yeah, it's true. Your average 50-year-old needs us less or is less time consuming when they do need us than your average 75-year-old. But we have patients whom I'm very grateful for, people who clean the local hotels for a living, retired school teachers, et cetera, who it's worth it to them to spend a significant little chunk of their monthly income to maintain a doctor that they feel like they have a relationship with that they can't replace with someone else. And the last thing I want to do is ask those people for more money.
Your $145 a month translates to $1,740 a year, $1,740 a year. You're in Hawaii. I'm in the greater Los Angeles area, and concierge physicians, direct primary care physicians here charge, in my experience, and a number of my clients do this, charge between $3,500 and $8,000 a year, $3,500 to $8,000 a year, and typical, I would say, is $4,000 or $5,000 a year. You're at $1,740. Is that because it's Hawaii, or are your fees lower?
I think you could certainly make the case that our fees are, quote unquote, too low, in the sense that, yes, I could have more income. And we could have a bigger house and drive nicer cars. If we charge more money, it would probably be financially viable, especially because with the pandemic, the Big Island has become this haven for the rich and famous. And we're really the only practice of this sort that is anywhere near where all the rich and famous move to, which is the dry, sunny side of the island. So, yes, we do pick up a lot of calls from people of this nature for whom you're right. I mean, $5,000 a year is a rounding error on their taxes, and it wouldn't matter to them at all. So I suppose if I were a better business person, I would find a way to do something more like marginal cost pricing where I could charge my loyal patients who were born on this island who don't have those kinds of fabulous means a more reasonable fee, and then really try to go after the people who just don't care about money. They have so much of it. I just hate doing that kind of thing. And so we haven't really explored that. And maybe if I were a better business person, I would. But like you said, most of us doctors are crummy business people. My wife is definitely the better one of the two of us.
It's interesting. You finally said in the show we did last time and to this point in this show, you finally said something I don't agree with, and that is that you're not a good business person. I don't think what you're doing reflects that. I had the same questions for my dad. Why don't you raise your prices? You're only charging $15 for an office visit, and sometimes that office visit is 20 minutes, and sometimes it's 2.5 hours. Why aren't you charging more for more time? Why aren't you just charging more? Because it's worth more. And my dad gave the same answer that you gave, except he didn't say he was a bad business person. What he said was, If I did that, I would not have the patients who can't afford me, and I like them. He said, I'll make up for that with investments in the stock market and in real estate. He said, I'll be fine, but I like those patients. I don't want to lose them.
Yeah, I think most doctors feel that way, that real people with real jobs and real concerns are often the most appreciative patients that we have. Now, that said, I feel really fortunate. Maybe there's a little bit of a filter effect before someone chooses to move to the Big Island, regardless of their income, that people ask me frequently. My colleagues often have envy or scorn for me in terms of, this is a cop-out move that I made, getting off the rat race, and or like, you're so lucky that you pulled this off. I hate my position right now. And middle managers tell me everything that I can do and when I can tie my shoes and how long to have with a patient. But however you look at it, they assume that I've got these needy patients who, because they're paying me X amount per month, expect me to go, run to their house every time they have a runny nose. And almost all my patients are really lovely in that regard. And we don't deal with much entitlement at all. And I'm grateful for that. But there's a difference between caring for someone who, just sold their startup for dozens of millions of dollars and has got three doctors at the Mayo Clinic that they fly back and forth on their private jet every few months. And I'm just, the stiff with a microscope, with a stethoscope, who listens to their lungs if they happen to get pneumonia while they're here on the island in their third home. It's just less satisfying for me than if I've got someone who is a retiree who really cares about their health and really values my role in trying to facilitate it. It's more satisfying to work with a patient like that for whom I'm really their doctor and not just a standby for when they can't get to the Mayo Clinic.
How do you deal with it when you have an entitled patient, someone who, and maybe entitled's not fair, an overutilizing patient, someone who is hypochondriacal, calling all the time, wants to spend more time than is necessary? Do you create structures that allow that patient to remain? Do you ask that patient to leave the practice? What do you do?
That's another question that often get from colleagues, assuming that is a regular problem. And it's remarkable how rarely that comes up at all. And I think most of that comes down to the fact that people that have got extra income to spend on seeing a physician are usually successful people in life, and they don't want to spend a bunch of time talking to their doctor about things that aren't important. Now, there are a very small handful of patients who might ask for a little more than they really need to, or certainly a disproportionate share of our attention compared to the average patient. And it's literally maybe once a year that I have to have that conversation with a patient saying, look, I would love to be able to research your questions about a disease that your sister has that you're worried you might have someday. However, I do have 300 some other patients to care for. And, can we please limit this to more germane problems that I can really help you with? And, they usually hear it okay, but it almost never happens.
Quoting from irisintegrativehealth.com, you say, we want to work with you to do what it takes for you to achieve your personal health goals, whether that means helping you reorganize your kitchen, offering classes on cooking or fitness, organizing a hike, run, or swim, or troubleshooting barriers to good sleep or meaningful personal time. Now, of course, you're going to see patients promptly when they are sick, and you'll make referrals to specialists, and you'll order tests, and you'll see them in the hospital, and you'll do all the things you'd expect from an old-fashioned primary care physician, a traditional one. But what percentage of your patients take you up on these extra ideas? How many people lean in to the notion of whole human health rather than you're a doctor, give me a prescription, I'll be on my way?
That's a good question. I would say that it's probably about somewhere a third, maybe I could even shift up to a half of patients have a real genuine interest in being well, and then a fair amount that either because they've got other physicians or they're really just not that interested in doing the work for their health, and they'd rather take a medicine. They'd rather just be told what to do and have it be as simple as possible. Or they're too busy to change things, or they like the way they eat too much to really change their diet much. But again, I think we've got a bit of an outlier population because these are people who are willing to invest in their health, and most people are either unable or unwilling to do so. And certainly have a lot of patients that they are very interested in having long sit downs with us. I mean, and it's all kinds of things. We have a couple patients who are interested in running, and my wife is a runner, and you know, some of them will go and they'll work on their running style with her and get coaching on that. A lot of patients are very motivated to change their diet, and I mean, we can easily can I spend half an hour just having a discussion about what they should be eating, how they should be preparing it, how we can evaluate whether this is a successful move. There's so many things of that nature that I think are probably more important to somebody's health. I mean, if someone's got high blood pressure and you give them a medication and it brings it down, it's all nice and simple and fast, and it's sort of what you have to do if you've got a couple thousand patients and you just don't have the time. But it's not some sort of woo-woo thing to say that you can bring blood pressure down through ways other than medications, and even other than just recommending, you know, the boilerplate things like a low-salt diet and getting more exercise, although that can be very effective. But we see it happen all the time. People, they have stressors in their life, whether it's work-related or relationship-related, and they either change their life or change the way they relate to the stressors. You see things happen, like blood pressure stabilize. And I feel lucky that I've got the time to delve into these matters, because that's part of a patient's overall health. If they are motivated to see a counselor or tackle problems that they've been putting off for years in their family life from a conversation that we have that really can get to the base of where is the anxiety in their life coming from, if they can make those changes or at least start to address them, I feel like I have done so much more for their overall quality of life and health than if we had a brief visit, we didn't even have time to talk about what's really going on in their life, and we adjust their blood pressure medicines and say, you know, come back in 2 months, take some readings at home, let me know how it goes.
You really are helping me today, allowing me today to truly revisit my dad's medical practice, because the descriptions you're giving of the miracle of self-healing when guided by a true healer, a physician who will truly help in this way, it's a miracle. And the stories of recovery of people whose lives were not obviously and not directly, but powerfully indirectly affected by health, where they didn't realize how anxious they were, and that all of the effects agglomerate into, I can't sleep at night, or I feel anxiety, or whatever it was. And when you really sort back and solve problems, really solve problems as a physician, as a healer, it's more than, let me just write your prescription. It's way more. And it's a gift that you're giving to your patients while you're giving it to yourself. I have another thought, but let me let you comment on that.
Well, and I agree absolutely, and especially about the selfish aspect of that as a physician. That is something that I've had to slowly work my way towards, and I've learned a lot from my wife about this and a few mentors along the way. But when you, as a doctor, and I'm sure you can relate to this professionally as well, but when you're on the treadmill in the rat race and you're being told you have to see 25 or 40 or 60 patients a day, and the time is so short, It so changes your ability to really feel into a situation with a patient, because the whole day is just a race against time. That's really what it devolves into. And there's always more that you need to do. And it's all important because each of those 40 patients matters and their problems are real. And what it does, though, is it just, you would have to be an incredibly evolved being in 10 or 15 minutes tops to be able to really tune into what's going on in a patient's life that might be underlying the problems that they're telling you about. And to have enough time and the sort of emotional leisure during my day, because I'm not working so hard and so fast anymore, to look for those cues that you're getting from a patient that I used to just ignore or have to ignore. And, you know, so often a patient will start crying, talking about something, and there's that little voice that goes off in my head of, you know what, it might be normal to cry in a doctor's office, but it's probably not a good sign that everything's okay when that's what's coming out when you're with your doctor. And to know that that's the cue to start to slow things down, to maybe move away from the problem that they're telling you about, which might be their back pain or their numb left foot, but what's really going on so that this is causing so much pain that they are breaking down in front of, you know, sometimes a near stranger. That is the great gift to me. It makes my days, or it allows my days to feel like a real chapter in my life as well as other people's lives, and not just a job. And I'm so grateful for that.
It's a two-way filter, because what's happened dynamically is different than the static part. The static part is that you're not having to deal with insurance, and you're not having to deal with administrators and a great deal of paperwork, and you don't have to deal with complexities of money. You say, this is what I charge a month. They pay it. That's the end of that. And then you can focus on the patient. But it also acts as a patient filter. And this occurs to me when I asked you the question about abusive patients, overutilizing patients, patients who would waste your day and would call every day when they didn't need to. And you said, yeah, it's a frequent question you get, but it's not a frequent problem you have. And I think it's because there's an inherent filter in your system that's built into the system, where if someone is paying for this, it's probably mostly not seeking to spend more time with a doctor, but to avoid all the problems. I have, and I've said this to his face, so I'm not speaking behind his back, a superb gastroenterologist. I think he's gifted. I think he's talented. I think his medical insights are terrific, and everything from his bedside manner to his technical knowledge are right up to date and cutting edge. And we want to change doctors half the time because his office is so badly run. You are on hold forever. You can't get an appointment. When you get one, it's 4 months away. The appointment gets moved, something changes, everything goes wrong, and it's all in the front office, and it's ghastly. And you're not having those problems. I know your website says that irisintegrativehealth.com says that either you or Dr. Suber, Michelle Suber, your wife, will be available by cell phone 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And that is that in itself would be worth paying for, but it filters patients who are not looking for that.
Yeah, I think there's truth to that the people who find us generally know what it is that they want, and that's somebody that they can form a medical relationship with. And so part of that, you don't want to go into a relationship knowing you're going to break it with bad behavior. So I think that almost always holds out to be true with the people that join our practice. And if it isn't working, they leave it. And that's okay too.
You know, I started out today, as I usually do, with a list of just, you know, bullet points that I want to talk about, and I managed to get to, I don't know, probably 15% of them. And partly because you were had the delightful idea of asking me questions. I like that. And that worked out. That was a wonderful trip down memory lane. But what it leaves me with is we're at the end of an hour, and I want to talk with you about the big three issues in the larger picture of health coverage: quality, accessibility, and cost, and all the discussions about a one-payer system, about Medicare for all, about all of these issues. And we won't have time today. Will you come on the air with me again a few months from now? We'll talk about some of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I had some notes sketched out as well, Steve, and we didn't get into at all some of the practical consequences of, well, what happens if 25% of doctors decide they want to be direct primary care physicians? And what are the ways that the system might be able to absorb some of the central tenets of this sort of approach to medicine, or what are some of the ways that it would be a disaster in our country? And I try to keep an open mind about things and not just push for this because it's worked out well for me. And there is a shadow side as well as a light to people getting interested in this style of practice. And I do agree we could have a whole other conversation about that.
So, ladies and gentlemen, there's your teaser for what will come up sometime, I suspect, later this year with Dr. Buzz Hollander and with me. Dr. Hollander, I want to say thank you so much for being with me. This has been truly a joy. Walk down memory lane of my dad's medical practice and the inspiration from finding that someone who practices medicine the way my dad did all those decades ago is you're doing it now, and it's really great. It's really great. Thank you so much for being with me today here on TalkRadio1.com.
Thanks, Steve. I enjoyed it.
Ladies and gentlemen, my guest has been Dr. Buzz Hollander, Buzz Hollander, MD. And again, Buzz was on the show on January 22, 2022. If you'd like to listen to that show, a detailed explanation and discussion of COVID, you'll learn a lot of things that you really couldn't get from fragmented news coverage over a two-year period. Right here on TalkRadio1.com, that's January 22, 2022, just a few months ago. You can look that up and listen to it. Take a look, just for interest, at irisintegrativehealth.com, irisintegrativehealth.com. If you happen to be on the Big Island of Hawaii, you might be able to get on the waiting list and someday join that practice. Sounds like it would be a pretty good idea. My next show will be 1 week from today. My guest is going to be Ken Walsh, who has been with us many times before. He is an award-winning journalist and serves as contributing White House analyst. He's covered the White House for U.S. News and World Report since 1986. So that includes the presidencies of every president, starting with Ronald Reagan. He's the author of at least 9 books and has been on our show now, I think, 9 times. We're going to be talking about the current political conditions, what we can expect in the November elections this year and upcoming for 2024, from a little different perspective than you usually get if you're watching mainstream media or, heaven forbid, social media. Ladies and gentlemen, please use our Amazon, PayPal, and eBay links to support the fine programming here on TalkRadio1.com. I will be back next week. That's 1 week from today, Saturday, May 7, 2022, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. My email address, steve@talkradio1.com, steve@talkradioone.com. Thank you so much for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. I am Stephen Spearer. Throughout the country and around the world, this is TalkRadio1.com.